You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
One day at a time, sweet Jesus. I'm only human. I'm just a woman. Help me believe in what I could be and all that I am. Show me the stairway I have to climb.
All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 855-752-4842. It's Tuesday. That means Tuesday. My co-host Sandy and Sandy, the music.
Yeah, the music. It's all written by Kris Kristofferson, sung by others, most of it. All of it became number one hits, at least in the country world. He was kind of a genius lyricist. He was quite poetic. The guy was a Rhodes Scholar, Phi Beta Kappa, coming out of a Pomona College, a place in California that had lots of smart people going to it. And then he became, you know, sort of the Phi Beta Kappa participant in the Outlaws with Jennings and Willie Nelson. So, you know, he's an interesting guy.
So Sandy, could you foresee Israel invading Lebanon when after killing the Hezbollah leader? Did you have any inkling that they would be moving in this quickly?
Well, it's obviously hard to predict what Israel's going to do. I mean, the Golan Heights at the north of Israel have been the place of some ongoing problems, although I was in Israel several years ago, and the Golan Heights was totally peaceful at that point, safe, no problem. I stood in the Golan Heights, looked over into Lebanon and Jordan, and it's right there where a bunch of countries come together. But, the tensions that have been fraught with ever since the Gaza invasion, and Hezbollah, who views itself as an ally of the Hamas, and are both getting supplied to some extent by Iran, creates a problem for Israel with respect to the safety of those who live in the north. And there had been heightened activity both directions, and it's always kind of chicken and egg, you know. Why is it happening? Is it because Israel's firing rockets into Lebanon, or is it because Hezbollah is firing rockets into Israel? It's hard to figure out where it started, but it's ongoing. And those rockets coming in from Hezbollah had become enough of a problem that a lot of people in northern Israel had moved and had to find safer ground. And so that it would be viewed by the Israelis as the reason for this incursion. They want to create a buffer zone. But they did this before, and this all sort of developed before in the early 1980s. 1982, they moved into Lebanon, creating a buffer zone. But once you create a buffer zone, you have to maintain the buffer zone, and they occupied Lebanon for 18 years until the year 2000, which is an expensive, difficult process that involves physical risk for both the occupiers and the occupied. And most people would attribute that period of occupation to what it is that created Hezbollah in its current form, the sort of the guerrilla resistance force that is Hezbollah. And so my problem with all of this is that if you look at the short term, Israel's buying itself physical safety. But in the long term, unless they find a solution, I think, to the Palestinian issue, they simply create the next round of Hezbollah and the next round of Hamas. And I think that's really the worry.
You know, Sandy, it also means as the United States doesn't stand pat while Israel is starting to make these kinds of moves, we ourselves ramp up.
Well, we've sent more military to the Mideast. We've sent more ships to the Mideast, more planes to the Mideast. We're obviously going to be there in a show of force. I mean, I take some comfort from the proposition that I don't think the United States has ever had to commit troops to the defense of Israel. And so that I'm hopeful that the United States will not get drawn in directly to the conflict. But they obviously are rattling the American sword at Iran to try and keep Iran from doing anything that would be viewed by the United States as overly rash with respect to its support of Hezbollah and its activities, hostile activities towards Israel.
You know, Sandy, the times are different now than they were in the past because Iran is, you know, kind of connected to Russia and China, right? I mean, not like Iran is a pariah standing alone anymore.
No, I mean, you know, in fact, one of the other articles that to be read is one that talks about how the United States is having discussions with its Western allies about their concern about the increasingly close connection between North Korea, China, Russia, and Iran, who are the renegades as far as we're concerned, and we've sort of put those renegades together, you know.
Right.
China would be the one that would be the least likely to find comfort from the others because it doesn't need the others anywhere near as much as they would need China. But, you know, the fact is that we've created these bedfellows in some respects by the use of our sanctions and by the dint of the nature of our foreign policy. And it is probably something to be concerned about.
You know, Sandy, as I've been reading about this, and there are clearly some who believe that our government is not doing enough to deter these moves that are being made by Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel. What do you say to people who say our government is not doing all it can and all it should to prevent this continued forward movement by Israel and what appears to be ramping up something even bigger?
Well, you know, we do give money and we do give munitions to Israel. I'm not sure that Israel is entirely dependent upon us. I think that they have the capacity to operate unilaterally from us for some period of time. Israel is both strategically and morally important to the United States and to the rest of the world, I guess. And the question is, what kind of a tightrope can the world and the United States walk while supporting Israel, but while also maybe pushing Israel in the direction of sitting down at the table? And I know that those who are very staunch Israel supporters will say that, well, that happened in the past, and it was the offers were turned down by Hamas, and so, you know, this is now their just dessert. But I don't know. I think everything in the past is a sunk cost. It's something you need to ignore as you go forward, and you have to develop the future without being too fixated on the past. The past is what has messed up the Balkans and that part of the world for hundreds of years, and we shouldn't let it mess up the Israeli participation in the Mideast, and we ought to make sure that Israel doesn't let it do that.
All right, let's go to Mike from Kenosha. Good morning to you, Mike. You say what?
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it as always. If you don't mind, I'd like to tie in the Middle East with Jimmy Carter.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Yeah, there's a book that was released in 2012 called President's Club. It basically talks about transitioning between one administration to the next and how they work or sometimes don't work together in order to make it a fluid transition. Well, one thing that I learned that Jimmy Carter, after he left office, and when George H.W. Bush was preparing to invade Kuwait, Jimmy Carter went rogue. He ended up sending a letter warning to the UN Security Council as well as to the Arab League of Nations, saying that, hey, you know, go ahead and, you know, authorize or approve of HW coming into Kuwait, but do not let him or do not authorize the United States in this case, to go beyond Kuwait, because the plan is and was, as history reveals, that, you know, they wanted to expand their footprint. They're just looking for an excuse to come in. So he wrote this letter right before HW was going to expand the war in the Middle East, to the point where many members of the HW Bush administration wanted to charge Jimmy Carter with treason. But then they back down and say, no, because he was really just talking truth to power. Jimmy Carter was a guy who wanted to negotiate. He believed that if you put people in a room that were committed to resolve an issue, that it would be resolved. Unfortunately, he got backed in the corner. And his demise, I believe, is because he would not turn over the Shah of Iran. When Iran wanted the Shah just to prosecute for the Shah's crimes against their nation. But to Jimmy Carter's, I don't know, credit, I guess, he wouldn't do it. He honored, I think it was Gerald Ford's commitment to protect and shield the Shah. So anyway, at the end of the day, I think we can thank Jimmy Carter for at least standing up to the military-industrial complex and George H.W. Bush during the first Gulf War, because without him sticking his neck out and writing those two letters, one to the U.N. Security Council, the other to the Arab League of Nations, we might have had a whole different, I don't know, calendar when it comes to the Middle East. Finally, the Middle East has been a tinderbox for a long, long time, and the primary reason why nothing is solved and it continues is because of the huge mistrust. They don't trust each other, period.
Hey, Mike, thank you very much for the call. 855-752-4842. Sandy, a couple more things about this on the other side.
One day at a time, sweet Jesus, that's all I'm asking from you. Just give me the strength to do every day what I have to do. Yesterday's gone, sweet Jesus, and tomorrow
don't look so sad, I know it's over, but life goes on, and this old world will keep on turning. Let's just be glad we had some time to spend together. There's no need to watch the bridges that we're burning. Lay your head upon my pillow.
All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. Is it the Roy Rogers Show?
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Welcome back.
Price.
To the Earl Ingram Show, as always, you can join us at 855-752-4842. It's Tuesday. That means Tuesday is my co-host, Sandy Williams. And Sandy.
Chris Christopherson wasn't too happy a guy, I don't think. His music has a sort of a melancholy cast to it all, but he was a good songwriter, lots of hits.
Let me ask you quickly as we kind of wrap up this invasion. Well, incursion. You can call it whatever you want to call it. They're actually in the territory, and they've actually moved Israeli
troops. Apparently,
troops.
Yeah, the IDF. The troops have moved into Lebanon proper. Apparently, today, this morning. So that's an invasion of sorts. And the question is, like all these things, like Ukraine, like this, what is the end game? What's the end game of a military kind of a confrontation like this? Israel would say the end game here is to create a buffer for the northern portion of Israel and the occupants of it to get them out of nearby rocket range of Hezbollah and the guerrillas that are located there. But maintaining a buffer zone requires maintaining a buffer zone. And so, you know, this could lead to something like the 1982 to 2000 period of occupation, so that you have troops there in order to police the buffer zone. And so that becomes a source of constant conflict, expense, human danger.
You know, Sandy, right in the middle of a presidential election, the things that are going on, you know, in Ukraine, decisions, serious decisions that have to be made right now. And now this, how much of this really is going to impact or affect, do you think, anything at all with the election?
Well, that's kind of the silliness of the election process here, because almost anything can affect it. The American public seems willing to attribute to the president almost any and all things that happen, whether it's
right.
Simply coincidence in time or whether there's any causation or potential causative relationship at all. So I suspect all of it will contribute to at least an atmosphere. Donald Trump runs around saying, well, if I were president, nothing like this would ever happen.
Yeah.
And if I do become president, anything that is happening will immediately be solved and resolved. Neither one of those statements is any truer than the notion that the president and the governor of Georgia weren't in contact with one another. But on the other hand, people seem to give it some credence. So, you know, I don't know. We also have the strike to talk about.
Yes.
That's going to come on the heels of, and of course, the strike is not something over which the president, any president would have any control. There's jawboning, but the only president with any jawboning capacity with the labor unions is undoubtedly the sitting president right now, Joe Biden. And so, you know, that is going to be another issue that will be occurring during the period of this campaign. That issue could have an impact on our pocketbooks relatively quickly, because a huge volume of our imports comes in through the Eastern Seaboard, and this strike is the entire Eastern Seaboard from Maine to Texas.
So let me ask you, because if you're Iran, and it's almost, we are saying publicly, we want to keep Iran at bay, the United States.
Well, I think Iran wants to be kept at bay,
yes,
quite frankly.
So, yeah, they're
making public statements in the last week or two, which were clearly olive branch kinds of presentations to the United States, wanting to come to something more like a normalization of relationship with the United States. And I think we should understand that it's not at all clear exactly what Iran is in the way of an international body. Its internal politics are not as radical as we would make them out to be, and their foreign policies aren't necessarily as radical either. I mean, they've had rhetoric at the Khomeini level that and in the past that has been stridently or apparently stridently anti-Israeli, but the fact is that their conduct has been much more moderate. They have provided arms and provided support to their allies, as we do as well in the Mideast, but their direct involvement has been quite constrained. And when they have had involvement, the constraint of it has been quite obvious. The 100 rockets that they fired, or the various things they've done have all seemed to be premeditatedly constrained.
And measured, right.
Measured, yeah.
You know, Sandy, it is, I think we have to come to grips as the American people, this boogeyman that people want to continue to say is a boogeyman doesn't want to be a boogeyman.
Yeah, I think that's the case with many of them, actually. I mean, I think the fact that we paint somebody to be hostile in every way, I think that countries are going to act more or less in their own self-interest. And it isn't in many countries' self-interest to be a hostile power. It just isn't something that would be rationally part of their motivation.
All right, 855-752-4842. It's Tuesday. It means Tuesdays with my co-host Sandy Williams on the other side. We are going to be talking about, you know, the port strike.
Of the raindrops blowing soft against the window, and make believe you love me one more time. For the good time.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
All right, welcome back to the Grand Ole Opry.
This country. This actually is Kris Kristofferson and Rita Coolidge, who was his wife of 8 years. He had two children with her, and they did lots of music together.
Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 855-752-4842. It's Tuesday. That's Tuesday. It's my co-host Sandy Williams, and Sandy again, the music.
Yeah, Kris Kristofferson. I was sad to see that he died couple of days ago, and so I just picked out some music that he wrote, some of which this one is he participated in.
You know, he was a perfect kind of cowboy guy for cowboy movies.
Yeah,
that voice, that deep kind of gravelly voice, and just his look.
He seemed like somebody who woke up on Sunday morning with a headache pretty often.
Yeah, that he did.
Yeah,
Sandy. U.S. port strike. Dock workers at ports from Maine to Texas go on strike. Excuse me, a standoff risking new shortages. So, Sandy, help us understand, man. You've always talked about the supply side. I hadn't thought much at all about supply side anything until you and I, and you were talking about there was a big ship stuck up in
the Suez Canal.
In the Suez Canal.
Yeah.
And that, you remember that?
Oh, yeah. And the Suez Canal is just a very important artery for moving commerce from the east to the west. And that ship clogged the canal for months and caused some real changes in shipping patterns, the cost of shipping, the time period required for shipping. But that problem is dwarfed by the problem for the United States associated with no commerce coming in from the Atlantic whatsoever. People estimate it's $3.5 to $5 billion a day of lost commerce, some of which gets recovered in the catch-up after a strike is ended. But, you know, this is a reminder. These ports are owned on most of them operated on a privatized basis so that the government isn't operating the ports. Private entities employ these workers who are on strike. And so, you know, the government isn't in a position directly to settle the strike. The existing president, Joe Biden, has a very close connection to labor, might be in a position to use the bully pulpit to try and jawbone and try to effect a more rapid solution to the strike. But, you know, this is this has been a time coming, and this is the result of some trends that have occurred, obviously, in this process of the operation of these ports, some of which is automation and the elimination of jobs at a potentially relatively rapid clip as a lot of these cranes and everything else become operated by far fewer personnel. And then also, you know, the fact that probably there hasn't been a wage settlement for a period of time. So we're talking about catch-up. But, I mean, the demand apparently from labor starts out at 77% increase over 6 years. That's 11% a year, presumably, something like that. That's not going to happen, presumably. But, you know, this is going to be dicey.
Well, you know, Sandy, the other side of this is when you talk about dock workers, I always think about On the Waterfront, the movie. Marlon Brando.
Yeah.
And so you never really think about it, but it does go to show we really are reliant upon the rest of the world for our society to work.
Increasingly so. I mean, these container vessels come from the West and the East. You know, with the automobiles, all the foreign automobiles we get from Europe all come in through these eastern seaboard ports. Container vessels are come in like mad. In fact, when the bridge went down in Baltimore,
right,
that was one of those container vessels that hit the bridge bulwark and down it went. No, I mean, we have become, as the globalization has occurred, we have become entirely dependent upon international commerce, both coming and going, shipping out, shipping in. Our outboard shipments are stopped as well to the east. So, I mean, this is a big portion of our export commerce also goes out on ships. And so, you know, back in 1955, we were quite a contained economy. We didn't require the rest of the world to the same extent that we require the rest of the world now to both buy our goods and to sell us.
Well, I mean, we're even talking about food that comes in.
Well, and food that goes out. I mean,
yes,
our farmers, exports play an increasing role in farm profits as well.
So while we're talking about this, Sandy, they're asking for 77% over 4 years. We know they're not going to get anywhere near that. I was reading where some of these guys are making $150,000 a year, dock workers. Now, they work a lot of hours.
Yeah.
And it's hard labor, right? I mean, there's nobody sitting twiddling their thumbs on the dock. But the fact that, you know, this is not going to be solved tomorrow. Let's say, Sandy, this goes into several weeks. Will we start seeing some impact then?
Well, we'll certainly see impact within a couple of weeks based on, you know, the fuse that's associated with inventories. I'm confident that within a month we would see substantial impact. A month of $3 billion a day is almost $100 billion of impact on commerce, inboard and outboard. And, you know, we'll start experiencing, and the main effect of it would be to put some inflationary pressure. Shortages would cause things to get bid up. But, you know, it also could be the kind of thing that triggers a general slowdown in the economy, which could lead to recession.
Which they've done all of this to try to prevent that from happening. The government has done all of these different things, the Federal Reserve, to prevent that from happening, and now this thing could trigger it.
Yeah, you know, to be honest with you, this surprised me. I should have been reading more about it. I didn't realize that the strike was so imminent and was going to happen. And it's, to some extent, it feels like a shoe that fell out of nowhere. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know the staying power. If I were earning $150,000 a year, I'm not sure how long I'd be willing to stay out on strike and put that at risk. But I don't think the strike is about the people who are earning that much money. And I don't know exactly. I suspect that the strike might be more about the loss of the, how they're going to the control the loss of jobs based on technology.
Well, technology is inevitable.
Well, it is. Automation is inevitable, but there are ways in which workers could be, where you could stage the automation in a manner that would be less dramatic in terms of its impact on the workers.
Well, you know, Sandy, these people clearly are in a position where they're not as easy to replace as the auto workers were.
Well, that's why, you know, that's what... That's why government workers, many of them, are not allowed to strike, because they're in vital, they play vital roles in the economy, in the safety of people. In police, for instance, the police strikes aren't allowed in most jurisdictions. And maybe we have to rethink this notion of dock workers, because our economy is so dependent. This is like railroad. This is like a rail strike, and rail strikes have always been something that have been either not allowed or at least highly constrained. And this is probably will have more impact than a rail strike.
So you throw into that, Sandy, coming into the holiday times, with this time being the most, you know, profitable time of major companies, you know, the people who sell these kinds of things that people buy for holidays, this is their make or break time of the season. They certainly can't afford not to have a robust buying season.
Yeah. So, I mean, it'll be interesting how the first week of this strike will probably be important to watch to see and get a sense of how long it might play out. I mean, a long strike of this nature would be unbearable. Okay, so I just don't know what process you can go through. I think there are declarations, executive actions that the president can take in the face of national welfare issues that could result from this kind of a strike.
You know, sometimes, Sandy, and you always, you know, talked about coming out of World War II, how we were just totally independent of the other nations. And because the infrastructure of all those other nations had been destroyed coming out of World War II, and ours wasn't. And so, and I always, you know, when we used to have those conversations, it always made me think back to just how robust we were.
Yeah, we didn't know at the time just exactly the circumstance we were in, but it was an altogether unique circumstance where we had an economy that was untouched by a world war that had felled and destroyed the workings of the economies of so much of the rest of the world and essentially all of the developed world. And so there we were, standing alone, a robust economy. We had all of our industrial might intact. We had the capacity to shift from making military to civilian products. We could do it almost overnight. And we had 20 years, at least 20 years, from 1945 to 1965 or 70, where we were the world's economy.
So, you know, because I lived during that time and worked in industry and just, I never ever thought about that was a special time, right?
Yeah.
The Industrial Revolution, we just, or at least I didn't look at it. I thought the Industrial Revolution was going to last forever.
Well, it did last forever. It's just that it spread. You know, it spread to other countries.
Our shores,
and other countries got off their knees. But I mean, you know, we were the baby boomers, and we thought the world was our oyster, and it was.
Well, yes, right.
The world was our oyster. And everything came easily, and we didn't understand exactly why. I'm not sure Americans understood exactly why that we were in this unique position where we could set up the Marshall Plan and make it possible for the rest of the world to buy our goods. And, you know, we had a balance of payments that was extremely favorable to us for a long period of time as we were the world's manufacturer and exporter. And we helped the rest of the world get off their knees. And we did it to our own profit. You know, we sold them the equipment necessary to manufacture things. We helped them build factories. We helped them modernize. But lo and behold, by 1970, we faced the competition of Japanese and German automobiles and Japanese and German high-quality materials things manufactured in India, and pretty soon moved to China.
So let me ask you, Sandy, what happened with us in our nation and during those times that really kind of set the table for where we are now and all the wealth that America was able to accumulate? Do we begrudge other nations as they try to get up like China and who's looking out for its own people? I mean, do we ourselves?
Well, I think we failed to realize the extent to which, we accomplished that, but we didn't make it in a manner that other countries could make it, because we'll never be in that circumstance again, and hopefully no other country in the world will be in the circumstance we were in.
I want to continue this on the other side. 855-752-4842. It's the Earl Ingram Show, and it's Tuesdays with my co-host Sandy Williams. To the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 855-752-4842. It's Tuesday. That means Tuesday is my co-host, Sandy Williams. And Sandy, the music today has been?
Chris Christopherson. And that's Chris Christopherson singing one of his own songs. Prolific writer, smart guy, interesting guy, iconoclast.
Let me ask you this. You know, as we talk about, because, you know, several years back, you and I, and we were having these conversations about our nation, how we got to where we are, and the American people were able to benefit and lift themselves up. The timing was right. And so do we begrudge a nation like China for kind of doing what we did?
I think we do. I think somehow, you know, we're this nation of individualists, and I think we somehow think that our country individually accomplished through some sort of unique capability the position that we got during the 50s and 60s, where we were essentially dominating the world, to the point where I think we think we have a right to that the United States is not only entitled to domination in the world, but that we require it in order to be the comfortable, successful world country that we are, when in fact it's not necessary. We don't need to dominate the world in order to achieve great commercial success. We could have a number of countries in the world who are operating on an equal plane, who are trading with one another and all prospering. But I think that we have a belief that there's somehow that this is a zero-sum game, that this pie can only be cut up in so many pieces, and that success for others means a lack of success for us, that we need to dominate and control all the waterways and all of the rest of the world. People talk about China being much more aggressive in the South China Sea, but I'm not sure what they mean by that. Do they think that China is going to take over Vietnam? Because I don't think there's any inkling of that. Do we think that they're going to have sailing naval vessels that will police the South China Sea? Well, they probably will, just the way we police the seas of the world to make sure that our commerce is free to come and go. Do we think that China would use their naval vessels to keep our commercial vessels from getting access to the marketplaces? That would be an act of war, okay? That's an overt act of war. Do we really think that that's what's going to happen? Because I don't think that's a realistic view of, I don't think that China will want to commit an overt act of war in the name of its mercantile interests in the South China Sea, just the way we haven't done that with respect to our mercantile interest in all the seas of the world.
You know, Sandy, the reason, as you just stated, is it's not the way it was, and there are nations that aren't going to tolerate us controlling things the way we have in the past.
Well,
right.
Yeah,
I mean, they're developing nations.
Well, and also, it was much less expensive for us to control the world that was subject to being easily controlled.
Right.
It's going to become, and is obviously already becoming, enormously expensive for us. You know, the fact is that the 1990s, when they're analyzed, we had a GDP that was growing rapidly. We had a deficit, a national deficit that was shrinking, annual deficits to the point where we had annual surpluses. And part of that was because when the Cold War ended and Soviet Union imploded, we began to spend a lower percentage of our GDP on our defense. And that reduced the expenditure on defense, helped us move our budget and moved our economy in the direction of a peacetime economy that thrived. Okay, we were in the process and could have been in the process of eliminating national debt until George Bush II's administration decided to reduce taxes during a time of war. The time of war had increased our defense expenditures, taking us on a different tack, and reducing our taxes put us further in the hole. And so ever since then, we've been operating on a different basis. But we should remember that the 1990s and the success we were having then with our national budget had a lot to do with pulling in our horns internationally.
You know, Sandy, I wish we had more time, but we'll certainly get into this on Friday, because I think it's really important now at this juncture in the world that we as a nation have to start thinking. You know, Donald Trump says, make America first. Part of that, I kind of agree with.
Well, I think we have to.
I mean, as it relates to
international,
we can do better for the citizens of this nation.
Well, I think that his notion of America first is to make us the most powerful country in the world.
Yeah.
That's how we're first. I think what we ought to do is just think of America's interests and the interests of the American people.
That's what I mean.
First.
Yes.
And if we do that, we will start reordering our priorities in a manner that will help Tom, Dick, and Mary.
Yeah, so I really want to focus on that some on Friday. Thank you, Sandy, as always. Thank everybody who made the show go. Thank you, Calvin. Up next, Jane Madner and Greg Bach, Madner on Air. Have a great day. Lord.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.